From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, music industry leaders say business is strong, but weren't they just singing the blues? Then Nataki Garrett is the first Black leader of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and she wants everyone to feel welcome, unlike when she was young.
I grew up in Oakland. I'm sure I had friends who went up every year that never spoke about it to me, that never said, why don't you join us on this trip? Oh, and then later on, when I'm a grown-up and I've been working in the theater for 25 years, then they say, you never came?
In a new documentary on the amazing musical range of Linda Ronstadt, that's all coming up on The Frame. It's time for our end-of-the-week check-in with our friends at Variety. Today, I'm chatting with executive music editor Shirley Halperin. Yesterday, at a Variety Media Summit, she led a discussion on the state of the music industry. Her panel was titled, Don't Call It a Comeback, and I asked her to explain why.
It is very appropriate for the talk that we had because, you know, the music business is really seeing a comeback, a resurgence, double-digit growth. You know, streaming has completely changed the way that the business operates, and it's bringing more cash into the fold, which is huge, and it's keeping many, many companies afloat, not just the major labels, but indies and everything in between.
Your panel included representatives from traditional record labels and streaming sites, Pandora and YouTube. Where are their businesses most aligned, and where are their businesses probably the most different?
I think it kind of maybe piggybacks on a question that I asked about how there used to be this divide between North and South California. Silicon Valley was very much seen as a product and engineer town, and Hollywood was very much seen as the place for creatives and for storytelling. And I think that those two worlds have really begun to merge. A lot of it is because of giant streaming platforms like Netflix and Amazon, and on the music side, Pandora, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music. And it's just brought these sort of disparate parts or these parts that felt like they couldn't speak the same language together.
There is no music without singers and songwriters. And as the economic models have changed for the music business, how is that affecting artists? Do they feel like they are getting paid their fair share?
On the one hand, no, artists are not happy with how much they're being paid, but at least there's like a transparency to it. At least you can see where your streams are, who your audience is. There's information that you can glean from your data that will help you grow your business. So that's the plus side. On the negative side, as Congress has enacted the Music Modernization Act, which I won't get into the weeds of that, but it's meant to better the rates that songwriters and creators have been getting over decades. And beyond that, there's this new lane of income, which we spoke about at the conference, which is syncs. You know, syncs, basically placing songs in TV, music, commercials, other visual media. It wasn't a very sexy business like 10 or 15 years ago. And now it's become a huge revenue driver because there is so much media that needs music.
I was at my son's back-to-school night last night, and the high school English teacher was talking about how kids don't sit down and read books anymore. Their consumption habits are very different. And I think the same is true in terms of music. How is the way that people listen to music affecting the way that music is marketed and sold?
One thing about the way people listen to music is that they're relying sort of more and more on an algorithm. Music used to be something that was curated by humans, you know, whether it was your program director, your local DJ, even friends recommending songs to other friends. And now it's become, you know, this formula. The algorithm really does predict what you're going to hear. And there's been, you know, a little bit of discomfort in the music industry about that because, you know, not everything is democratic when it comes to music. Some things rise above because they're special or because they connect with people. And sometimes it requires the marketing and the promotion to put it out there so that people notice it. In terms of the way the music industry used to run, it was a transactional business. And now that it's completely shifted to a consumption model, it's required of the labels to get to know these fan bases as their customers. And that has completely changed the way that record companies work.
All of the panelists were women. The moderator, you, I don't know if that was by design or accident, but what does that say about women in music right now? And are they enjoying a little bit more success than they might be in film and television?
It was completely by accident. And it was really nice. You know, you're all coming from the same place. You've all sort of, you know, risen above and succeeded. You know, I'm one of these people who I never even thought about my gender until like these last few years. But, you know, everything that I've done in my career has been to, you know, elevate the gender and myself included. So there was something really interesting about having four incredibly successful women in different parts of the music industry who clearly understand what's going on and have like real visions for the present and the future. So, you know, I don't know what that says about women in music overall, but the fact that it just happened that way, and we've had a couple of events at Variety, especially on the music side, that have come up with parity, you know, without really trying. So maybe things are changing.
What was your takeaway on where the music industry is headed? There's so much going on. There's so much disruption. New technologies, new ways of finding music. Did you get a sense that things are going to continue to be chaotic, or does it feel like there's a settling out right now?
I don't think we're quite settled yet, and mostly because we're seeing all these tectonic shifts happen in real time, and we don't have the benefit of being able to process and properly analyze. You know, it's been said that the music industry is a bit of the Wild West right now, and I think it will continue to be for the next couple of years.
Shirley Halperin is the executive editor of music at Variety. Shirley, have a great weekend, and thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
You can follow what's going on in the entertainment industry at Variety.com. Coming up on The Frame, Nataki Garrett is the new artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and she's rewriting its script. Founded in 1935, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival is a theater lover's paradise tucked away in the rural town of Ashland, just north of the California border. Despite its name, it's hardly all Shakespeare all the time. The festival stages about a dozen productions every year, a mix of contemporary works and classical plays, some adapted for modern day. For the first time in more than a decade, the festival has a new artistic director. Nataki Garrett takes over from Bill Rausch, who went to Oregon from L.A.'s Cornerstone Theater and is now off to a new post in New York City. Garrett told me that as the festival's first artistic director who isn't white, she's having deep conversations with supporters about what it really means to bring in new audiences.
They've actually been asking me in every conversation I'm having with my stewarding audience, how are you going to diversify us? What are you going to do to make sure that people are coming, that other people that don't look like us, that are younger than us, that are from different cultural backgrounds? And my question back to them is, yes, what are you going to do? Like, how are you going to assist in that? It's a destination theater. You have to choose to come there. I grew up in Oakland. I'm sure I had friends who went up every year that never spoke about it to me. They never said, why don't you join us on this trip to Ashland?
Why wouldn't they say that?
Oh, it's tough because I know it's an exclusivized experience. It belongs to me. I'm supposed to be the one to go to it. Oh, and then later on when I'm a grown up and I've been working in the theater for 25 years, then they say, you never came? No, I never came. I was not invited. I didn't know anything about it. My mother worked three jobs. You know, that was not a part of my life. But I also feel like you never invited me
you
is my answer.
You weren't welcome.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not forward, like they're not forwardly excluding me from it. What they're doing is not remembering to bring me along as a way of saying this is something for us.
That gets to a fundamental issue that anybody who is running a nonprofit arts organization with a subscriber base faces. And that is, we have these people who are loyal customers and they keep coming year after year after year. And there are these new audiences that we want to develop. And often the new audience and the old audience aren't going to agree on the same thing. So how do we retain these people that are our lifeblood and give new audiences something that they're attracted to and maybe challenge these existing subscribers to open their minds to new kinds of art?
See, I think we're asking the wrong question.
Okay.
Because I remember saying this to a board member at the Denver Center who was saying that we're not planning on pandering to a younger audience. And he used that kind of language. And I said, you know, how long have you been coming to this place? And he said, oh, I remember the very first production, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And I said, and how old were you 30 or 40 years ago? That season was chosen for you. Those people sat and thought about what to deliver to you. I have to think about what to deliver to the next audience. Did you sit in that room by yourself? Were you the only person? Was everybody in the room your age? No. So I think the question is, how can we create a space where people feel confident enough to share their armchair rest with everybody else? That's where I think we have to ask. We have to figure out where is that intersection that traverses the divide between age and race and gender that says it's okay for me to sit next to you while we witness that.
You can take a classic play and you can stage it in a way and it can tell a new story. So when you think about classic works that can be reexamined, is it important to you to look at how these works live and breathe in the modern world? And does that feel exciting to you, or is it difficult?
It's both. It's both difficult and exciting. There are some plays written by, you know, our namesake playwright, Shakespeare, where I'm just appalled. And I know he's a man of his time, and it's really important to separate time from now. But I had somebody write me a letter where they wanted me to be aware of the impact of the work of Shakespeare on a new audience. And when we forgive because he's a man of his time, we forgive him for stories about rape and incest and stories about racism and stories that are anti-Semitic, anti-disability. When you have all of those things happening in a play, then you package it and you say, well, this is high art and you're supposed to like this. And if you don't like it, there's something wrong with you. And then you present that to middle school children, or you present that to high schoolers or college age people. And you're basically saying to them, you should figure out a way to accept this. This should be something that you should swallow. And so I think as a person who produces Shakespeare, I have to be very clear about the impact that I'm making, and where I have the most control is in the image. The word is powerful because of the image, because how the body holds it. That's where I can make the difference.
We're talking with Nataki Garrett, who is the new artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Good art is about conversation, and it's about a conversation that happens on many different levels. What can theater do that movies, music, TV, visual art can't do?
The struggle of theater is the unique power of theater. The struggle of theater is there's something about witnessing humanity live with other humans. There's something chemical or physiological that shifts in your heart and your brain and in your blood where you realize you're watching something, you're being a voyeur, you're watching something terrible, you're watching something delicious and funny, you're witnessing something and you're breathing the air with other people. That organic experience is something that is kind of singular to the theater, because you can deliver music, that's sound. You can deliver word, that's poetry. You can deliver movement, that's dance. You can do all of those things at the same time. And you do it in a room that's filled with other human beings. And the live exchange is immediate. It's not like you can re-experience it. And I think that's the separation. It's not a concert, right, where you have a barrier. And it's not a dance show where people aren't speaking. It's all of those things at once, and it's happening organically.
It's unfair for me to compare you to your predecessor, but he said something when I met with him a year ago. This is Bill Rauch, about art and politics. I just want to tell you what he said and see what you think about it. I think all art is political. I think all theater is political. You are naive if you say, I'm going to create this work of art, and this is the political impact it's going to have on the world. But I think it's even more naive and more dangerous if you don't recognize that whatever you do as an artist will have political impact because we are shaped daily by the art we consume.
Yeah, I agree with that. And yet, as a woman of color, I live in a body that has been politicized at birth, right? So I move into spaces and people say, oh, your politics are so loud, even if I haven't said anything. I am constantly bombarded by this idea of the politic of my body and my experience. And that's because I'm supposed to exist outside of the status quo. Recently, I had a conversation with somebody on my marketing team where I had to say, yes, of course, we have to focus on social justice. It is extremely important to make sure that people understand that we support those causes. And what is social justice? Social justice is trying to create a space in which I can just exist in my full dynamic experience and existence. I can simply just live and be and walk down the street and not have somebody point to me and say, hi, political entity, I'm going to politic myself around you. And so I think it's also important to remember why we do the work of politic. But our focus has to be on humanity.
Your first season won't be unveiled until 2021. But when you were thinking about, it's kind of like a fantasy football draft when you're picking your players, what are you looking for and what are you not looking for?
One of the things that I'm focused on as an artistic director and as an artist is I'm looking for a way to open our capacity for empathy through the work that we do. And the plays that I'm inspired by are plays that remind us of our basic humanity and inspire us to action so that we can create spaces where people can live their full dynamic lives. And that's extremely important to me as an artist and as a human being. And as an artistic director, my goal is to locate those plays and try to figure out first if they are impactful in the way that I stated, if they can give us a deeper sense of who we are in our profound humanity, and if they can lead us towards the possibility for a better future, a brighter future, and a future for the people that we're raising to populate this world. If they don't do those things, then I'm not interested in it. And that's including Shakespeare. When I do produce Shakespeare, I'm looking for a way to shake things up in the way that the populist playwright Shakespeare was looking for a way to shake things up and engage. Shakespeare wrote plays for royalty so that he could afford to write the plays for the people. And I'm interested in the gap between those two spaces as well. And I'm interested in the intersection between those two spaces. And that's how I program a season, looking for new plays, new writers, new ideas, new thoughts, new forms. I went to CalArts, so I have a little bit of avant-garde in me. And so I'm always interested in a way of stretching this idea of the image and ways that we can strand the viewer from convention so that they might be able to locate something deeper inside their own experience. And then the last thing is, how will those plays affect the people on the other side of the footlights? What happens to my audience when I'm asking them to engage with each other in their experience of witnessing a story? I'm always looking for a way for the people who meet on the armrest to engage with one another on their side of the footlights. And that's my little secret in the work that I do.
Nataki Garrett is the new artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland, Oregon. Nataki, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, a new documentary explores the varied career of Linda Ronstadt. The true Linda Ronstadt fan knows that the singer, now 73, was much more than a rock star. She was a musical innovator with a stunning range, from light opera to pop standards to traditional Mexican folk songs. Filmmakers Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman explored her career in the new film, Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice. They told me about the L.A. music scene that Ronstadt joined in her early 20s.
Well, the Troubadour was the happening place, and it seems to be where a lot of musicians that we've come to know and love got their start, and Linda was among them. So Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, they all started in L.A. at the Troubadour, and it's where Linda was first heard when she was performing with the Stone Ponies by David Geffen.
I want to play an early song that Linda Ronstadt records, and first I'm going to play a clip from the film. And this song might be familiar to a lot of people who know Linda Ronstadt's songs. So this one is called Different Drum. So that's her recording of it or performance of it in the film. And this is the version that probably most of us have heard. So I'm going to ask you a little bit about the people that Linda Ronstadt worked with, what role the producers and engineers played in the development of her music, because same song, but a very different sound.
The producer had a very strong idea of what the arrangement was going to be for that. And Linda at first was taken aback when she heard it because she was so used to the folky version. So it took her a while to make that adjustment, but of course she realizes that that's what helped to make it a hit. People may not realize that it was originally written by a man, Michael Nesmith, who went on to become part of the Monkees. And the song's about a man not wanting to get tied down to any one woman, and Linda turned that on its head. We really came to see her story as one of empowerment. I mean, she was a woman who was making it in a male world, this music world that was controlled by men, and making it on her own terms, and a pioneer in that regard.
Linda Ronstadt had an unbelievable range, and she could sing anything. It felt like she was always hungry. She wanted to try new things, if it was a comic opera, if it was old standards. Why was she so driven to not stay just doing rock? What was behind that motivation, do you think?
She is an artist, and I think she was just restless and unsatisfied to keep repeating what she'd been doing in the past. She describes it as having to sing the same thing over and over again until it starts to sound like your washing machine. But these are genres and styles that she grew up listening to, and they were all part of her authentic musical DNA. And they were things that she wanted to get back to. It was the music that she loved. And at a certain point in her career, she was successful enough to be able to say, okay, I want to do something completely different now.
Along those same lines, she was told no a lot of times by record executives. And I think, as was often the case, when they said no, they wished they had said yes. So the album is called Canciones de mi Padre, Songs of My Father, and it not only is critically successful, I think to this day, it's the largest selling Spanish language album in U.S. recorded music history. Is that right?
I think that still holds.
Why was that important to her? And when she was told no, how did she get around that? How did she prevail?
Yeah, well, the record companies were baffled by her choices at that point in her career, but she was bound and determined. And as she says at one point in an interview in the film from that period, she said, "This is music. If I don't do, I will die." I mean, she was a musical adventurer. Once she had her sights on what that next adventure was going to be, it was going to happen come hell or high water.
There's a scene toward the end of the film in which Linda Ronstadt is singing or trying to sing, and it's very touching. I think some people could read it as heartbreaking. I thought it was beautiful. What was it like to film the scene with Linda with Parkinson's trying to sing?
We wanted to find a way to include Linda in the present tense, knowing the condition that she said she wasn't willing or able to do a sit-down interview. Late in the game, she was doing this trip to Mexico and invited our cameras to participate and let us film this very intimate scene of her singing with her nephew and her cousin. And I think from Linda's perspective, it felt like a very natural, organic way to let the audience in on her present tense without making any kind of issue of it without making any kind of point. It was just a moment where you get to see her living her life very fully, completely engaged. Music is still very much a part of her life. As she says, she still sings in her mind. And this was a rare moment where she's also singing very intimately with family.
Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman's new documentary is called Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice. Rob and Jeffrey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
The Linda Ronstadt documentary is in select theaters starting today. And that's it for the week. Thanks to the team that produces The Frame and to Taylor McFerrin, who supplies our opening theme music. I'm John Horn, and make sure to tune in to The Frame Weekend, which airs Saturday at 2 o'clock. We're back here on Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend.